to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and join me once again, the water donut to my sourdough. It's Brian. Hey, Brian. How you doing this evening?
Hey, Scott. Okay. How you doing?
I'm doing fairly well. We are recording a couple days later than normal, but we're both thrilled with our respective baseball teams just won their baseball games just a few minutes before we started recording.
Yes.
Because who knows how much more baseball we'll get this season, so I think we're trying to cram in every possible minute we can.
Get it while we can.
Exactly, which is my motto in so many things in life. Phrasing. Anyway, but the reason, of course, once again, why we're here tonight is to discuss Perry Mason, and more significantly, the final episode of season one of Perry Mason, aka chapter 8. So, normally, as we've done with the previous 7 chapters, we tended to record within like an hour or so of the episode airing, so a lot of it was immediate reaction, having to be on our toes. Maybe we might have to correct ourselves the following week, who knows. So we do benefit from the fact that now we've had a couple days, and I think based on our pre-podcast conversation, we've actually both watched the episode 2 times each. So we have no excuse for forgetting anything about the episode, that's for sure.
Well, don't tell them that, because we probably will, but we'll do our best.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, if there's one thing I'm good at in life, it's jinxing myself. I wouldn't say we've got a lot of stuff to cover just based on this specific episode and how it transpired, but there's still a lot of other things that I want to make sure we pack into the podcast, because at least for the next several months, year, who knows, because of COVID-19, this will be our final Perry Mason podcast for a while. So I'll just keep popping those peas. Anyway, the episode actually starts off, we learn that Sister Alice, she's still missing in action, and Birdie, I'm finally calling her by her name for the first time in eight podcasts, Birdie is getting stitches while determining what her next moves are. I almost found it inexplicable that her daughter could have disappeared that easily, but, you know, I went along with it. But what's actually more interesting is also Seidel is nowhere to be found. Nobody is aware of the fact that he's actually dead now. But you can see Birdie, as we kind of mentioned in previous podcasts when we talked a little bit about her character, she's definitely more the calculating, manipulative type. You can see she's already hatching a new plan and how to handle things. And I think she by the end of that scene, she drops a note to somebody that they need to reach out to Emily Dodson, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right. Right. And that's the note delivered later at the trial.
Exactly. Now, speaking of Emily, she's kind of had a little bit of a switch because of what happened, obviously, at the graveside. I always get confused if I should say graveside or gravesite. Anyway, she's no longer delusional about her son's resurrection. You know, she's hanging out, or I guess she's staying at the boarding house where Della and Hazel live. She's kind of beating herself up for acting like a crazy lady, and she's obviously upset, as any reasonably even non-crazy person would be, that her child's body is missing. The one thing I realized with the delusion kind of stricken away from her eyes, she's become a lot more self-aware now, as well as aware of how that jury is going to be seeing her.
Well, the artifice of her son being resurrected, that was going to be her salvation. And now she knows it's going to go to the jury and they're going to have to decide her fate.
Yes, and just, I think, coming to grips with just not just reality in general, but that stark reality has probably left her. It is why she's kind of beating herself up. She's kind of resolved to, I think at this point she's probably wondering, is she just going to go to prison or is she going to the electric chair at this point? I love this. We go from here. This is when we splash to the title card across the screen. And if there's one thing we've been enjoying about this season, it's the way they use these old timey, like something out of a either an old movie or actually some old 50s TV shows, full title card for the episode, including even like the copyright at the bottom.
Yeah, I love that. And it's not, and also it allows them to tell more story. You don't take up any of the time with a credit.
Right.
It just jumps you right into the story.
Yeah, I'm definitely curious, since we know there is going to be a season two, if for the second season, if they will actually have an opening credit sequence. I'm gonna predict they will. I know that seems odd since they didn't have one all this season, but I have a feeling that I obviously could be wrong, but I think they will. You probably can anticipate why. I'll get into why when we get closer to the end of the podcast. But I was talking about this over the weekend with someone who was also very appreciative of the way they do the title cards. And I said, yeah, there's some TV shows that are kind of known for doing that in a very original or intriguing way. And of course, HBO, as of late, is one of those shows that's been doing it. I mean, they certainly have done it with this show. People were very aware of how they did the opening title credit for Westworld, which was more about the title of the episode rather than the opening credits. But, same difference. And you can think of other shows that kind of play with how they use on-screen credits, whether it be, the way Preacher would do it, which is a very imaginative way of doing things. Or if you're watching a show on Netflix, like Mindhunter, where it just fills up the screen in an almost insane manner. I just like when television series, be they streaming, cable, or whatever, kind of do things in a little bit different way. It's an eye-catching way, but it doesn't, interfere with the flow of whatever it is you're watching. So I get a kick out of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I like it because they obviously made a choice and they stayed with it for the whole season, and it was really enjoyable.
Yeah, I love the fact that just over the last few weeks, the couple of shows I've been watching were doing it in a way where I was just very happy or looking forward to how they would do it each week. This show, especially because as we discussed before, I love how not only are the words on the screen, but they would play with it a little bit. It might have that old timey look, but then they would have an effect like the person or objects kind of appearing around the letters, giving almost a three dimensional quality, which is certainly something you did not see done, whether it be for a 1930s serial or a 1950s TV show. So, back to actual story. So what we're witnessing as the opening title is there, we're seeing Ennis being sworn in on the stand. And this whole, one of the fun pieces of work in the entire episode is watching Perry, connecting the dots as he links the dirty, murdering scumbag detective, both to the Elder Seidel and to the kidnappers. He goes back to when they were apparently hired to crack heads and who knows what else. There were union busters or strike breakers, which I think are the same thing that I said out loud, at some factory in Colorado years earlier. But the interesting thing, as anyone paying attention becomes more and more aware, as Perry is hammering away, making these sly and outrageous asides to make his points with the jury, despite whatever objections Barnes is making, we're also seeing little scenes or even flashes of just what Ennis did that night. And it was when they started doing that, my first thought was, oh, I'm starting to feel like this is more of a final act kind of scene rather than a first act. So I had that little second or two of confusion. It's almost as if we were flashing forward. And then when you start noticing Hamilton Berger is in the galley, inaudibly, whispering to Della, who can only shake her head. And when he stands up in the galley and declares that this strategy won't work, that you don't get a confession on the stand, I was like, oh, probably 5 seconds before the scene changed, I realized what was happening. That's when the entire illusion is stripped away, and we see this is just Perry running through possible scenarios at home with Della, Paul, and Hamilton Berger there. And him saying over and over, and once again, a more than generously sly wink at the Perry Mason mythos when he keeps saying no one ever confesses on the stand. And even if folks don't really know Perry Mason, whether it be the books or the TV shows, they've probably heard at some point that's what they were famous for. Perry Mason would break someone on the stand and get a confession. It was in all the books. It was in the TV show. It's a Perry Mason kind of thing. Whenever you hear anything like that happen in a trial, which I don't need to be a lawyer like you, Brian, to know that generally doesn't happen.
You know, no, it doesn't.
If it happens once in a million times, that's something. But it's someone going for like a Perry Mason like moment. So I really enjoyed. It's once again, I thought they were being kind of deliberately self aware of where of the source material, and I really did get a massive kick out of that.
Yeah, I like that it basically subverted the Perry Mason gimmick right away. And I made the mistake of reading a couple of reviews that didn't like that. And I couldn't disagree more. I thought that the way that's going, and I think we've talked previously that Ennis was not, unless you had the goods on him, you know, he wasn't just going to cave to Perry Mason and Perry came to that realization, and it pivoted to what, and I'll say something as a trial lawyer, and I have a couple of friends that are trial lawyers, and all of us have tried a lot of cases. The common wisdom seems to be to not put your client on the stand. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've never bought into that, and a client who's on the stand and can do a good job and tell their story sometimes is all you got, especially if it's self-defense or, explaining something that you can't explain because they're the only one there. But if you leave those holes open, a jury will fill them in to your detriment. Generally, right. They won't give you the benefit of the doubt. And I think Della does a good job of convincing him to take that gamble. It's a pivot. Basically, from Perry Mason's strategy to also go against the traditional wisdom where you don't put your client on the stand.
Right. Yeah, because it's kind of almost a TV trope when someone doesn't I can't tell you how many times I've seen that over the years where there's a situation where they're not going to put the client on the stand. And the argument, against that is, well, what would the jury think? You know, it's always, what will the jury think? Because if you don't put the client on the stand, then they're going to think something's up, you know. And I imagine, you know, whether it be fiction or real life, it really depends on your confidence in your client and whether not just how they can tell their story and, but how they will hold up under a cross-examination. It's funny. It's also what was hinted at initially with Ennis, because we saw Ennis kind of rehearsing to a certain extent with Barnes in a previous episode. In a weird way, getting this little fantasy scenario, I guess, is our way of being, is our only way we're going to get this hunger satisfied as far as seeing Ennis on the stand, because Berger makes the point that you're not going to win, you know, the case with him on the stand. You don't,
right.
If you don't, and Paul also agrees. I think he says something along the lines of, you know, you don't go after him unless you got him, and you really don't got him.
And exactly.
Correct me if I'm wrong, one of the more well-known, almost cliches, when it comes to, you know, questioning a witness, especially someone you want, you know, you're trying to expose or prove a point or whatever, you know, you don't ask a question that you don't already know the answer to.
Absolutely.
And by extension, you don't have someone on the stand unless you know damn well where you're going to be able to eventually go. And even in that scene with him and Ennis, he never gets to a point where he really cracks him. Perry keeps supplying the information, but he never gets the confirmation from Ennis. So it's just him. And then we find out during the scene in the house that many of the things Perry is saying aren't actually even true. that he, right. he doesn't actually have these, you know, either be these two witnesses or this or that or the other thing. He's making stuff up a little bit, which I'm pretty sure you might get caught on if you went that far. At least if the DA is paying attention.
Well, you can, but I'll tell just a brief anecdote of a time where an officer was not talking about a video that occurred in a jail, but we knew there had been a video in a jail, and I had a videotape sitting on the table that wasn't a videotape of the jail. And this tells how long ago this was, that it was actually a VHS cassette. And I had just sat it on the corner of the table during my cross-examination, and the officer, I said, you know, they videotape in the jail. And he said, after a pause, he looked at me and looked at the tape and goes, yes, so you know they recorded in there. And he said, yes. And my only point of that was, is there was a difference of opinion between my client, what she had said and what he had said. And I knew there was a videotape in the jail. And we were going to point out that, you know, that had she lied, they would have played the tape.
Right.
And, you know, so I didn't tell him that was the tape, but I didn't tell him it wasn't either.
Right. I think, again, I don't, not to keep beating the word trope to death, but just my feeling on when I watch legal dramas unfold, again, be it TV, film, or even stage, one of the more popular comparisons or analogies for trying a case is there's something to it being like poker, because there is going to be bluffing involved. And like what you just described kind of strikes me as that.
It's like, oh yeah,
you know, it's because like you were talking about a videotape. It's like, well, they're very well, it probably likely is a videotape, and you're just implying it might be that tape that's actually on your table right there, even though it's actually not. So that's, I mean, it's an excellent bluff, because it's not like someone's going to suddenly pull out a VCR. It's like, well, put that in right now, let's see what it is, you know. Although, who knows, maybe it could have happened.
Anyway. Right. Well, I mean, the bottom line is this, is that There's a degree of performance in theater to it, mm-hmm. that jurors find compelling, because a lot of trials, unlike TV, is tedium. And when you can get their interest and get them to sit up and pay attention, you can bookmark important notes in their head that you come back to in closing argument.
Right. Makes perfect sense. So back to this conversation, because I do like having, I should also point out that it's nice to have in this moment four of the principal characters of Perry Mason lore all together for the first time. So I thought that was kind of interesting, because you have Perry Mason, Della Street, Paul Drake, and Hamilton Berger, you know, i.e. your four main characters from the TV series and the books and so on. If you look at the, you know, cast of characters, those are usually your top four before we get to everybody else. I'll mention it now instead of later in the podcast. I have neglected to mention one other thing as far as characters from the original source material. There is actually another character in this series that pre-exists, that actually is from the Perry Mason books. I don't think he was ever used on the TV series, or if he was, he might have appeared only in one or two episodes. I'm not sure about that. I think he might have actually, but he was a recurring character throughout a number of the novels, and that is Detective Holcomb. Detective Holcomb is actually from the books, several. He's, as I would put it, he's a bit of a son of a bitch, but he's not the corrupt cop that we see here. So, you know, I wouldn't exactly call him an ally, but he's not this.
Right.
But that also, between knowing that he is actually from the Perry Mason lore, and also the way this episode eventually ends, that also tells me we will be seeing him again. I would be very surprised for him not to also be one of the characters returning for season two. Not just because he survives this season, but also he's been part of the Perry Mason mythos as well. So I'd be very surprised if he doesn't return.
I hope so. And I didn't know that going into the show, and didn't know until you had told me. And I like the fact that I didn't know at one point. I think, you know, we were worried Ennis would off him.
Yep.
And, you know, so this whole show has sort of flipped a lot of the expectations of the viewer in an interesting way.
Right. Absolutely. And during the course of this scene also, oh, that's where Paul has that lovely little line when Perry is insisting he was doing well and even questions Paul about it, because I guess Paul looks like he was the one standing in for Ennis during their little rehearsal here. And that's where he has the line, "You were drowning, I threw you a water donut." And I just kept thinking how much I liked the phrase water donut. It kept sticking in my head. I was like, I'm not even sure if I know what it means, but I'm going to use it. And then so when I start recording, like, oh, water donut, sourdough. Oh, got my opening. There we go. Anyway. As you had already indicated, it's also during this scene where Della brings up the idea of putting Emily on the stand. And we go from the interior scene. Also, by the way, I do love Hamilton just wanting to get the hell out of there because, you know, saying that someone's ego has just gotten, it's just filling up the room or something along those lines is pretty excellent. Because, yeah, Perry Mason, whether it be this version or any version, I don't think of him as being the most humble character. He does have a bit of an ego. Might be a lawyer thing, because I'm starting to think of like famous lawyers, you know, TV lawyers, I should say. They all have a certain ego about them to a certain extent. I don't care if you're, you know, Jimmy McGill, Matt Locke, the James Spader character from Boston Legal, the dudes in The Practice, whatever, every other character on LA Law, you know, or The Good Wife, they all have that certain kind of ego to them. Maybe it's, hey, Brian, maybe it's something about taking that job to begin with. You need to have a bit of an ego about you.
Well, I think there's a fine line between self-confidence and an ego, and a lot of lawyers cross that. But you certainly, if you're going to be a trial lawyer and say, I'm going to make it my duty to stand up in front of people and convince them to think what I want them to think, mm-hmm. you do have to have a certain degree of self-confidence to do that.
Right. Because, and also, it's, no matter how you look at it, because is it someone who, you know, is more interested in, you know, righteous justice, and then they see themselves as being something of a hero character. That takes a certain sort of ego. Or there's a person who needs to, this is not the category I often fall into, unfortunately, and why I would get jokes over the course of my lifetime, like, oh, I'm surprised you didn't try to be a lawyer, because I have this need to be right all the time.
You know, even right.
Often to my detriment, be it, you know, either be friends, relationships, whatever, probably cost me, it's definitely cost me a few over the years. And then there's just the ego of someone who's like being confident that they can, well, to reuse a word that I used earlier about somebody, that you can, you know, change minds or manipulate or, you know, get people, you know, which I mean, obviously you need to be confident in yourself in order to pull that off. Anyway, so there you go. There's how to be a lawyer. No, I'm just kidding. don't want to skip by the scene with Perry and Della outside, because it's a pretty rough moment between these two. And I kind of, well, I didn't kind of, I like the scene because there's, while Perry is being he's being cruel, but it doesn't mean there might not be some truth to what he's saying. Or at least, at the very least, that maybe it needed to be said because of the way that Della has been going about things. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, there was nothing wrong with what Della has been doing. And I believe her when she's spoken about her. But the certain phrases that she used. So when he points out, oh, this is about a woman being demeaned by men, and that he, you know, he makes the comment that she's using Emily as her proxy. That's the real point of her crusade here. It might not be true, but at the same time, it would be foolish not to think that's not fueling things to a certain degree. I don't think anyone's motivations are totally pure or altruistic all the time. And even though even if that is fueling it, it's not that she's wrong. She has every right to think that, and she's right about it. But she shouldn't be in denial about it either, because yeah, that does have a lot to do with this, what's happening here.
Yeah, and what in my mind that represents is Perry can't prove the case otherwise. And there are many speeches in this episode about, what's the truth if you can't prove it? It's nothing, right? And so basically, Della has convinced him to try what is a very dangerous gambit, because let's be honest, if she gets on the stand and they hate her, they're going to hang her. And it's a very dangerous all-in sort of move that has him a little freaked out. And so, he's not on board with it in that moment, but I think he's mad because he sees maybe it's his only play.
Right. And there's a number of reasons why he would be concerned about it beyond the obvious. Because, at this point, it is all he has, but he's not the one who prepped her. So he doesn't know at this moment, he doesn't know going into it what to expect. He hasn't spent hours and hours with her going over what she's going to say, how he's going to kind of guide her, direct it, et cetera, which I imagine would normally have been the case to at least to some degree. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying. You don't put someone on scent unless you know what they're going to say. Plus, the way she's been, especially as of late, I mean, he wasn't there with her to see that she's kind of the fog has been lifted from her eyes, so to speak. But he does know the way she's going to be perceived by everybody, in the first place as being this adulteress who didn't care enough about her kid. She decided to have sex in the other room and ignore his cries and all that, which you knew Barnes was going to be hammering that point, because that's it's lecherous crap like that is what, is building his case for him. It's just making people just be disgusted with her rather than proving, an actual case against her. And also the thing can't forget is that this is also Perry's first shot at being a lawyer. So there's also that. He doesn't have the normal confidence of someone, he's not EB or even Barnes or someone who's been doing this for years and maybe they could, have done this before, could figure out how they're going to go about things. This is his first time. So he's a not, he's still, it doesn't matter how many times he's sat during a trial. He's never been a trial lawyer himself. So there's that pressure, stress, and uncertainty. He doesn't, there, at least in this moment, he doesn't have that confidence we were just talking about that a lawyer needs to have. We see something like it a little bit later in one of the more impressive moments for Matthew Rhys on the show, but we're not seeing it at this point when he's as upset and stressed out as he is.
No, what he's saying is, I mean, he doesn't have the proof. He's pissed off that this innocent woman may go to prison or be killed. And what he's in essence saying, this whole scene is saying to Della, you better be right.
Yeah, exactly. And if we had just said that, we could have saved everybody 5 minutes of me yapping. No, just kidding. So one way to save a little time, we get a couple quick things before we get back to the trial. We get a quick moment of Paul talking to his wife, which is really just about scene setting. It's like, oh, that's what's going on with these two. Thanks for letting us know. Let's move on. We also get a nice little scene between Perry and Pete. So yay, Pete's back. Where Pete gets a little caught up on what's been going on as far as Seidel and how the baby actually died. But the scene is about him asking for Pete's help. I love Pete's line to him about, other than, waiting for that apology. And he gets kind of a, not exactly apology, more like, no, I know how hard you work, as opposed to an actual apology. But I love the line where Pete says, maybe this is just you in a suit.
Yeah.
I thought that was, oh, that's one of those things. If you're when I would read someone's script, like doing a critique of it or giving them feedback, I would put a little asterisk. And I don't mean a Houston asterisk, like a, put a little star next to that. It's like, ah, good line. You said everything in a really short way. So I really enjoyed that. I'm tempted to go a little further with the Pete thing, but maybe I'll wait till later for that.
Let's wait.
Yeah. So we get Emily on the stand, and similar to when we saw the fantasy scenario of Annis on the stand, while she's speaking, we also then flash to what happened that night. Actually, the scene opens before we even get to her on the stand, but it opens with a flashback of the night of the kidnapping. It's her with the baby, Matthew leaving, then her getting the call from George Gannon that eventually distracts her, because I guess they must know that she's going to go in the other room and stay in the other room on the phone, because they don't have cordlesses back then.
Right.
So, so I guess Gannon knew that the phone was way over on the other side of the house, and someone could sn they could sneak into the house and take the baby without her being aware of it, which I do buy and believe it. For me, the entire scene between Perry and her, and he allows her to do the quote unquote heavy lifting as it should be. It's very sad, it's teary, it's poignant. And good Lord, most of it really, at least in my eyes, gets undermined when Barnes cross-examines her. So, I mean, it's not that I think it's a waste, because I think they did make certain points, and at least she didn't come off looking like a lunatic. But Barnes is working hard to paint her a certain way, just the way that Della had feared. And you do have a jury that, if I'm not mistaken, is. It's mostly men on that jury, if I'm not mistaken. So,
Yes.
it's your classic, it's your older white men kind of thing, especially in the 1930s. You're trying to appeal to the pious among them, so to speak.
And the only note on her testimony is in prepping her, she should have been prepared for the answer of, was this your fault? She didn't take the baby. She didn't try to get the money. If she said something, someone else chose to act on it. If they didn't act on it, the baby's alive. You can't blame her for saying information and putting it out there and knowing someone would turn that into a crime, a kidnapping, and a murder.
Right.
But I do think she probably got to a couple of jurors, and that may have saved the day.
If it and if that didn't, that combined with Perry's later closing statement certainly did, which is
And yes, and Perry, and possibly Perry and Pete's Gambit,
right.
but we'll.
We'll get there.
Yep.
I knew where we are in the episode. I remember the digital counter as I was watching the show. So, after this, outside the courthouse, that's when that some guy that working for Birdie, or maybe perhaps one of the elders himself, slips her a note. And we also see this little encounter between Perry and both Holcomb and Ennis, where Perry lands a punch in Ennis's face, which is kind of nice. And of course, and Holcomb like then grabs him and puts him up, beat the crap out of him, whatever he yells at him. I kept thinking, oh yeah, Holcomb's more the quiet menace, but in some ways he can be a bit scarier than Ennis is. Ennis is the guy who pretty much has killed everybody. Later that night, we also get a little kind of a wrap, or to a certain extent, or being a wrap on one of the storylines that maybe I wasn't focusing on too much during the course of the series, the stuff going on with Perry and Lupe. Perry is busy mumbling into himself as he's trying to rehearse his closing argument and the order of how he's going to go about it. And that's when Lupe walks over and saying, I think she drops like an envelope of money, like $7,000 on top of the debt that she's paid off, plus a bottle of mezcal. And he's almost as rough with her as he was with Della earlier in the episode. I mean, obviously, he's clearly distracted and he's got, in the moment, more important things on his mind, a woman's life he's trying to save. But he's still a little rough with her, but much the way Della kind of rebuked him and appropriately in her scene, Lupe does the same thing here. And it's actually even more important, at least for her character, because I think we didn't really know. We could only assume things about her. Because of the time period and because of who she is, she kind of clarifies it for us, the reason why she needs that property. to quote her or semi-quote her, she mentions that there's actually 30 airfields in L.A. at that point. But once Prohibition ends, that number is probably going to drop down to 5. And to use her phrase, she's both a wetback and a woman, so she needs to stay ahead of them, you know, really in order to survive. So that's, even though she does clearly care about Perry, she's not being greedy. She genuinely needs that property in order to actually make something of this situation with her own airfield and be able to survive the likely culling of all these airfields once Prohibition ends.
Well, many people in this episode attempt to pierce Perry's ego, and most of them get through to him on some level. It happens with Pete. It happens with Della. It happens with Lupe. He's caught up in what he has to do and isn't listening or hearing people around him and being kind of an ass. And they all sort of rebuke him in ways that, that I think get through to him on some level.
Right. The only risk in doing this, and it's fine for this episode, it's just something that the writer should be aware of when we go into season 2, especially. Unless your desire is to make the show and the character more worrisomely, wow, the character almost formulaic, you don't want to keep doing that.
Right.
Because it becomes a little Johnny One Note. And it's a kind of, that would be a note that, you know, whether it be a producer or a studio, whatever, if they're really in tune to the story, they would say that, they would go through a script and go, yeah, there's too many, this is a repetition we keep getting with this character. And, you know, you can't, if you keep doing that, then he's always, it's like everyone's ahead of the character, so to speak.
He needs to learn and grow. Otherwise, you know, what's the point if he doesn't develop through these circumstances?
Right. That's exactly where I was trying to go with that. Thank you. So after all that, got a couple other little things out of the way. That's where we see at the boarding house, Emily opens a note and we see it's a baby's footprint. So we know this is going to lead her to go see Birdie later in the episode, supposedly. We see Perry rehearsing. I really enjoyed that. Again, it was showing because he's, again, we were saying before about confidence, whatever. It's like he's trying to build himself up, but he's unsure of what he's doing. You know, he keeps trying to figure out how he's going to hammer certain points, how he's going to phrase certain things, you know, because as you well know, you know, an ill-chosen word or phrase can mean life or death.
Right. Yeah, I thought, and that's very realistic that oftentimes you hit the wall trying to come up with a theme or a phrase or something. And I thought it was well acted and well done.
Right. And speaking of well acted and well done, this obviously takes us to his, what I would call his magnificent closing statement. What's really nice about it is how it works. It's again one of these instances of character and plot working side by side, because, you know, plot wise it's a great summation and hopeful vindication of Emily Dodson, but, you know, character wise a lot of it is also a summation and hopeful redemption of Perry, because this is his moment to shine and also to make up for some of the things he's done, not just in the course of the season, but as we get the impression throughout his life. So I think this is important to him, not solely because he's trying to save a woman's life, even though maybe that's how he's projecting it.
Yeah, it's just great. The only quibble and the only lawyer quibble is, you know, Perry Mason may be lucky enough to only ever represent innocent people. But, you know, as a lawyer, if you say, my job is to make sure the guilty get punishment, that's not a defense lawyer's job. Now, in that case, I assume this being his first time, you know, he really plays that up. But overall, other than that general, you know, lawyer quibble, for dramatic purposes, I thought he absolutely shined. He was humble in the way he delivered it, the way he tried to blunt some of the prosecution without doing the things that could alienate jurors. I thought it was excellent.
Right. And I also thought it was interesting that when Barnes follows him, Barnes is surprisingly succinct. I mean, obviously, we weren't going to sit through, you know, several minutes of Matthew Rhys and then go to several minutes of Stephen Root. It just wouldn't have worked story-wise the way they would have told this tale. But it still was a little bit surprising. Like, oh, he just made a couple points. Bing, 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 bing. I'm going to sit down now. So that was a little surprising.
And you know, shout out to Stephen Root for his deliciously evil DA.
Oh yeah, and the scowling he does later on in the episode is insane. it's like Snidely Whiplash was wincing. it was so joyously over the top, and you know, with that little pencil thin mustache, and then what he does later outside with the reporter, it's excellent. We jump a little bit because we see Perry in court kind of, you know, pretty much taking a snooze, and then we discover this is 3 days later and they're still waiting on the jury. And it's at this point that he tries to apologize to Della for the way he acted, well, now several nights ago. What's significant about this little scene is it's the first time, I think, in the series where they speak about continuing their working relationship beyond that case. So that's kind of like, oh, that's important, because now you're telling us there's going to be more Perry Mason. and we also get, you know, we also get an okay and then a very good EB impression in the scene.
Yes. I liked it. Waiting on jurors is the worst. It's brutal. And they conveyed that very succinctly, and them sharing a genuine human moment. A fond remembrance of EB. You know, there are a couple of nods to EB. Later we see Perry has his briefcase. Yes. So it was nice to see EB just mentioned in passing. You know, RIP to EB Jonathan.
There you go. We also, something I was wondering how they were going to handle it, but I think we mentioned it on a previous podcast, you know, the expectation of we're going to see that envelope of money again when Paul Drake actually quits the force. Because, yes, he does toss down that money. I'm guessing he didn't spend a dollar of it. Goddamn righteous motherfucker. I loved him. There's something about that character and him delivering these short clip lines. It's like between him and Pete, they tend to deliver the best lines on the show just about. I just, like, had some things to do, Joe. And just by saying Joe, the way the guy reacts to that, the captain reacts to that from that point on. It's like, okay, he's kind of already, we know where he's going, and now it's clear that he knows where he's going. Because I don't think he does that without knowing he's now going to be their investigator from that point on.
Right.
So I got a big kick out of that. And of course, we go back to trial, and blah, 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 jury is deadlocked. It's a mistrial. I believe that was where they were going to go with it. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I believe... I wouldn't have been able to believe she would get acquitted. I didn't think they were going to find her guilty in this situation. You know, I don't think they were going to bum us out after watching this for 8 episodes. So I thought the mistrial was the most obvious, or should I say the most likely outcome of that trial.
I leaned that way after we saw they were waiting on 3 days of jury deliberations.
Yeah.
The second the bailiff walked out and said they had a note, I mean, I had a sense that's where it was going, and then I knew.
Right. I mean, unless they had done something over the top where she was found guilty, but before she was going to be put to death, they got some sort of, you know, public confession, whatever, from Ennis or something. I wouldn't have known how they could have pulled that off, and it would have been believable without being silly. And this is before the days of TV, so it's not like you'd be caught on camera. So I was like, no, it's got to be a mistrial. We do, you know, post that occurrence, we get the outside the courthouse, and we see both, you know, Barnes on one side and Perry on the other side. They're both holding court with reporters and going about things in a very different manner. Barnes is pretty much trying to guarantee that this case is going to be retried. That's etched in stone. Just him saying that made me think, nah, you're telling me it's not going to happen. Right there, you're never going to retry this case. And meanwhile, on the other side, Perry is acting super morally outraged that it wasn't an acquittal. And I love that he even yells at Holcomb as he walks by all the way in the background. He starts screaming at him about hiding Edison or the blue line and stuff.
Yeah, I love that he took a minute to yell at Holcomb. And it was interesting. Ennis wasn't there. And, him pointing that out to the papers, putting on a show that his client's innocent, just feet away from Barnes. I like that. And he's right. You know, a mistrial is better than a loss. And sometimes the case is never retried. You'd much rather have that than a loss. A DA is always going to say they'll retry it because guess what? The public moves on and forgets because the new case comes along. But we learn, that Barnes is focused on being the mayor. And I did think it was interesting that the outburst he had at a reporter. I guess in the 1930s, he was powerful enough that you wouldn't report that or it would probably hurt you, because if that was reported, I would imagine that would have been the end of his career.
Yes, I was going to leave that scene for you, that when it's right when the reporter asks him about how this trial or the outcome might impact him running for mayor, which they had hinted at already in the series that this, I think we all knew from the get-go, he's just using this case as a massive popularity stepping stone to get to the mayor. I don't know if it was, I couldn't remember if it was mayor or governor, but I was assuming mayor. And where Barnes drops a couple major F-bombs there. You know, what's it like to walk around with half a fucking brain when fucking Fishrat pays you? That was kind of, that might be one of the more surprising things in the entire episode for me. Was just, Barnes, who, if there's one character knows about, manipulating the media and it would be him. So you'd think he'd be the last one to lose it in public that way. So,
but that tells you that he lost in a way. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. If his big scowly face that we just saw a couple minutes ago didn't tell you that, did.
Right.
Now we get to the thing we hinted at before, where we see Pete meeting by, I don't think it was a Hollywood Bowl, but some outdoor atrium, whatever. And we discover he meets up with one of the jurors, and that he had paid off a juror, which I'm guessing, and I don't even want to say guessing, I'm assuming that is the job that Perry was referring to early in the episode. Because at this point, before we see that moment, one might be wondering, wait a minute, what was it that Perry wanted Pete to do? He wanted him to do something that Paul, that had to be him. It couldn't be Paul to do it. It's this. And I know that there may be some folks who might have recoiled at this or might have been confused by this. I wasn't. Simply because I went back to, and we've discussed it in great detail in a previous podcast, what this version of Perry Mason's, what his mantra was. And if, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't have it in front of me, but it was something along the lines of, doing what's right is more important than doing what's legal. Something like that. And he knows full well, there's no question his client is innocent. There's no question in his mind, or anyone who's been going through this case, that Ennis is the one responsible for all the, for all these deaths and so on and so forth. And there's nothing he can do about that now. So, yeah, there's nothing surprising to me that he did something like this, which would be giving himself an insurance policy. The joke of the scene, if it's that, is the fact that they didn't have to do that. Because we discovered through this juror that there were actually two other jurors who were stubbornly not going to change their opinions. So my impression was it was nine against Emily and 3-4. So they didn't need to sully themselves this way.
Right. Well, I think that the evidence to me that, you know, I'm sure there are people that won't want to believe this, but upon rewatching the episode, I don't think there's any question Perry did it for the very reason they leave vague what the job is. Mm-hmm. that he meets Pete out in the middle of nowhere to do the meetup. And that when at the after celebration, I don't even call it a celebration. I my notes say the least joyous post-trial celebration ever. that when Della is talking about the jury, Perry looks visibly uncomfortable mm-hmm. about it, almost like knowing he didn't have to do it, but he did.
Right, because she's talking about two of them, but she was surprised about the third one, and
right.
the third one is the one that they paid off.
Right.
Just to address it now, so I don't forget, because there was a couple things some folks I know on the social media online, on Facebook, were asking about or wondering about, and I had said earlier today I was going to address them. This was actually one of those points. So it's what we've said already. I would also say, because then someone brought up, oh, I believe they're probably going to bring this up as being an issue or a possible issue in the second season. Now, obviously, I don't know anything for sure, but I'm going to say they're not. That we're not. They're not going to address this the following season, and they're not. And the reason why I'm saying they're not going to address it, and again, I may be giving you the reasons I give, may be the reasons why they should address it. I don't know, because of Pete's involvement. And Pete, it will, as we're going to discover during that, you know, least festive celebration ever, Pete is now going to be working for the other side, for Hamilton Burger. So it gets a little messy, because if you had a situation where it came out that Perry Mason, you know, this defense attorney, had paid off one of the jurors, but the person who actually did the payoff for him was someone working on behalf of the DA, you know, i.e. the prosecution, people who are now in position of prosecuting cases now, you see the can of worms it starts to open, how it calls both sides into question and what they do. I just don't think they want to, I would be very surprised if they want to get mired in that. I would be shocked. I think this is just one of those things where we saw it happen, and the folly of it is that it wasn't really even necessary. If there were a few more episodes of this season, then yes, I would be genuinely shocked if they brought it up. And if I turn out to be wrong, I will lead off that podcast saying I was wrong. But I don't think I'm wrong on this one.
I agree with you for a few reasons. Number one, the case ended in a mistrial. Number two, Pete going to work for the DA, for all the reasons you said. But number three, what it sets up even more compellingly is that Pete knows now that Perry and he did that. Perry probably won't be inclined to try that move again with Pete on the other side.
Right.
That it's a one-off.
As he mentions early in the episode, only someone like Pete could be the one to do this.
Right.
Paul, who's now going to be his investigator, is not the type of person who would have anything to do with that kind of action.
No, not at all.
It's almost like you've already built in your check and balance by having someone who probably, you know, is probably going to be more morally upright than you are. As we saw when he tosses down that money, you know, because, you know, you and me, I was saying, I'd keep some of it. <You know? laughs>
Well, it's almost like the conversation on the dam or the bridge is almost like, I just need you to do this one last thing for me.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think as a nod to their friendship and partnership, Pete does it. And I think that's it. Mm-hmm.
And of course, we should be happy just in general, since not only do we know we're getting a second season, but by establishing that Pete is now going to work for Hamilton Burger, who will pretty, you can pretty much count on from this point on, whether there's two seasons or seven seasons of Perry Mason, Hamilton Berger will be the opposing counsel, because he, you know, with very few exceptions, if they decide to change that up. But that's kind of the Perry Mason storyline. It's always him opposing Hamilton Berger. Could they possibly change it? Maybe, but I doubt it. And therefore, we'll always see Pete kind of being on their side. So it also brings up an interesting dynamic I could foresee for future seasons, or at least second season, because, you know, Pete working as Hamilton's investigator and Paul working as, oh, Peter and Paul. Interesting. Anyway, and Paul working for Perry, we may see those two kind of clash or compete or whatever. And that I don't think we've quite seen that dynamic yet. So that might be a kind of a fun thing, you know, for future seasons.
Well, and the interesting dynamic will be both sides sort of know how the other thinks.
Yes, exactly. They definitely will have, they will both have people who have been worked on the other side of the aisle, so to speak. So they will have insight that maybe those opposing sides wouldn't normally have. So, and you know, there's a lot of things to like going forward, because, you know, coming from someone who's watched a lot of, again, different major legal dramas, you know, TV dramas over the years, it's exceedingly rare that you quote unquote like the opposing counsel. That you may get the you love to hate kind of thing. For, you know, for example, The Good Wife was excellent with this. They would have, you know, outrageous and great, you know, actors as opposing counsel, who, you know, whether they were chewing the scenery or not, but we all remember, anyone who watched The Good Wife would remember the characters that played by people like Michael J. Fox or Martha Plimpton and so on and so forth, you know, but we love to hate them. Like, we were always, but this is interesting because from what they've established, at least in these couple episodes of season one, we kind of like Hamilton Berger. You know, he's not, I mean, obviously he's helping, you know, by helping Perry, he's also helping himself, because there's nothing he'd like to see more than Barnes lose, because, you know, it'll help him move up in the ranks. But there's something about him that was like, oh, he's a likable guy. We see his relationship with Della, and it'll be interesting how they explain, whether they take what might have just been a joke and actually run with it as far as the whole possible, you know, they could be each other's beards kind of a thing, which I think would be kind of an interesting way to go.
Right.
So I just like that, because, and of course we love Pete already. So it'll be interesting to watch cases where, oh my gosh, I like people on both sides. Will they ever dare to have Perry lose? Because they probably won't, but you know, that would be kind of interesting as well.
Yeah. I mean, the big note is it's interesting to see the pieces moved on the chessboard to opposite sides. And hey, you know, we speculated, will we get more Shea Whigham? And we're going to get more Shea Whigham, so we're all for that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So when we move beyond that, we do finally see Emily does go to see Birdie and meets that baby. And, of course, the baby. It's not Charlie. And the way the scene kind of plays out, there's a certain creepy but definitely tragic nature to the whole thing. I think it's when you realize that Emily is going to go along with this charade. It's when she gives the baby Charlie's little stuffed turtle. To me, you know, they kind of foreshadowed that with the turtle early in the episode, as well as previous episodes. And that's when I went, oh, she's going to go along with this. Oh, that's interesting. I wonder where they can go with that. And then we discover during what I call the show doing kind of a musical coda, so to speak, where we have some music playing, and then we kind of cut from different scenes to kind of, we start tying up little storylines here and there, you know, like Lupe walking into the house, and then she sees that Perry's clearly moved out, and there's a bottle of mezcal, is now empty, and there's a note in there, and then we see a little bit later when she's able to get the note out of the bottle that it says, the price is fair, look after the cows. So now we know, oh, okay, now that relationship has come to its resolution, and it's not, you know, not in a negative fashion, which was kind of nice.
Yeah, and just briefly to go back to Emily Dotson, I think the reality of Emily Dotson is tragic because Birdie gives her a future that is no doubt painful. But what would a disgraced, divorced woman in her circumstance do to support herself or survive? And it's probably easier for her to tell herself that painful lie and live that lie than to try to make it. And keep in mind the time, as we've talked about, that, that America was going through then, that what would Emily Dotson have done, divorced and alone? And, you know, it's really kind of a, it's really kind of a tragic ending for her nonetheless.
Right. But ultimately it turns out that these two people need each other.
Yes.
Because everything you just said about Emily is why she needs to go along with this. And now that, because Sister Alice disappeared, if Birdie is going to do what eventually we see is like the traveling evangelical roadshow, and you know, with whatever handful of acolytes that will follow along with her, there needs to be an attraction, you know, and our main attraction, so to speak. You don't got Sister Alice anymore, but now you have, you know, the mother and her with her resurrected baby. That's your main attraction, you know, and it's a little, it's unseemly as hell, but you do what you got to do. And none of this is beyond what we think Birdie would be capable of, because one of, and I'm skipping ahead just for a moment of some things I was going to mention after we finished the episode. One of the few remaining mysteries of the season, or unresolved aspects of the season, is what actually happened to Charlie Dodson's body. And I'm pretty sure the reason why that shouldn't be that big a deal to most people is we're pretty sure Birdie's behind that. We don't think Sister Alice is behind it. We think Birdie is behind it. Now, what did they actually do with that body? I don't know. Whether he just buried it in an unmarked grave somewhere else, like, I'm assuming it had to be something like that. They certainly wouldn't throw away a baby's body. That would be just beyond the pale. But it could be something along those lines. But the point being, if this woman was willing to do that, and even though I understood why she would do that because of this, because what Sister Alice is going to try to do was insane, her moving forward with this roadshow, with this resurrected baby thing, makes perfect sense. It's like she's going back and starting over, so to speak.
Right. No, I totally agree.
Other things that we do see during that little, as I referred to it, the musical coda or whatever, we see that Paul and his wife, and they have a new child, they've moved into a new house. We do get to see, you know, momentarily Hamilton Burger in court, yay, with Pete on the stand because they're going after the church and the finances and all that kind of stuff. We cut through all that. Let's get to one of the most fun things in the entire episode. The negotiation between Perry and Della, which is witnessed by Paul. How much fun was that?
Oh, it was great. It was great. And you see whatever problems they've had, that now there's some coming together of them as a team. And Della telling him she's going to go to school and she's going to be a lawyer, and Perry saying, "Oh, a woman lawyer." And she says, "No, just a lawyer." And,
no modifier, you know, which,
yes,
which is funny. I'll be honest, you know, although I'm a reasonably intelligent person, I probably wasn't until the last few years that I actually heard the phrase or the word modifier used as often as I've heard it in recent years. So it was kind of funny hearing it used like in the 1930s and especially exactly the way that people use or mock its use in recent years. So it's definitely a modern wink at something that taking place in, you know, the 1930s.
Yeah. But seeing the team finally assembled, this is like, you know, the Avengers finally are all together, all the, and seeing them together, is great. And it's funny that they're talking and Paul says, you know, there's a client waiting outside.
Right. Oh, well, that's what I want to get to next.
And Paul is the cut to the chase guy. And like you say, he, with an economy of words, he gets straight to the point and makes really his point clear and has some really good lines.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's a very fun little scene here. Because it's not a series that we got that many light moments. But I think it's also important to see a scene like this between these characters because we really want to get a sense of their chemistry together. And you can see that through, you know, dramatic scenes between them, but you need to have some humorous scenes as well. Because that will be one of the reasons you're going to want to come back and watch these people, you know, play their part, so to speak. So, about that client. As you mentioned, Paul was waiting for a client. Said client is waiting.
Eva Griffin.
Now, for those who don't already know this, and I have a feeling if people have been going online and reading this stuff, they probably have found out about this, which spoiled what I would have said if we had recorded on Sunday, but whatever. That character is actually the client in the very first Perry Mason novel, The Case of the Velvet Claws. I've actually read that book. You know, it's a very twisted little story. It's your usual things. It's your murder. It's your blackmail. Perry Mason himself actually gets involved in the whole thing. So I can see them deciding to use that as the basis for their next season. So that is a possibility. I don't know if this is an actual foreshadowing of what season two is going to be about, or it's more of a little kind of wink at the very first true Perry Mason case, but that, you know, when season two might pick up 6 months later, it could pick up a year later, who knows? So I don't want to go out on a limb and say this is definitely what season two is going to be about, the way some folks out there have assumed. If they had gotten an actress that I knew in this one little moment with Eva Griffin, then maybe I would believe that was possible. You know, if Kate Blanchett walked, well, maybe someone not that big, but yeah, if Kate Blanchett walked in as Eva Griffin, I'd be like, oh, okay, now I know what it's going to be. But here, I can't guarantee that, but it's certainly possible. The other thing the reason why is because not only is it from the books, it was even the basis for a 1936 Perry Mason film, and there were, I think there was a two-parter, which was kind of rare. And I might be wrong about this. I think there's a two-parter that was done based on this that happened like midway during the run from the 50s and 60s on the Raymond Burr TV show. It was almost like a special episode, special two-parter of Perry Mason that involved this case. So the fact that it is that significant, I know, gives it some credence as this is what season two is going to be about. I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to say, oh, they got a lot of time. They might not, they might just have dropped that here as kind of like almost more of a gag. And then we'll see. Because just the fact that all she really says is, I'm in trouble. And he says, oh, then, you know, you've come to the right place, so to speak, kind of makes me think, okay, they might not really be going there. Then that might have just been a little name drop and a little wink at the Perry Mason lore, mythos, whatever you want to call it.
Well, it's a nice end cap to a show that subverted so much of the Perry Mason history that this is sort of, an Easter egg to the Perry Mason fans to yes. say, you know, this is the Perry Mason world that we inhabit. And here's, you know, the first real client. Because if you look at Emily Dotson, she really wasn't his client. She was E.B.'s client. And so, you know, he just inherited the case. But I thought it was a nice touch. Obviously, not knowing anything about it, I looked into it and read some of it. And boy, does that story, without giving any spoilers, sure is film noir in its in its machinations.
I can totally see them doing it. I just don't want to go as far as saying that's what they're going to do. You know what I mean? I'm not sure. I also don't know if when they come back for a second season, will there just be one case and one case only? Will there be a couple other, you know, competing storylines? I don't know how they're going to go about the show in season two. The only thing I know is because of the way they designed season one, plus the fact this is an HBO show, we can be pretty certain we're not going to be getting the typical Perry Mason procedural that we, that older people might be accustomed to from the original TV show, which then kind of created the template for shows that came after. You know, there's no Matlock if there's no Perry Mason, so on and so forth.
But I
see though they might go there. They probably will. I just don't want to. I'm not guaranteeing it. Is what I'm saying.
I'm calling my shot. They're not doing it. They're not going to have a femme fatale at the center of season two.
Well, there you go. You heard it here first. Brian said it.
So when I'm wrong and you're wrong, we can begin podcasts sometime in 2021 or 2022 saying we were wrong, wrong, wrong.
It'll be welcome to the Wrong Guys podcast. It's got Brian. Actually, we'll change our name. It's Brought and Sky in. Anyway. Hey, did you see that tweet that someone put out today? Some people were, you know, that before we heard, we realized who Joe Biden was going to pick. They say Joe Biden was picking Bran for. That's my favorite tweet. I don't know if anyone who was fed up with Game of Thrones needed to put that tweet on their page today. I thought that was the funniest thing. I read that.
That's pretty good.
All right. All right, we only got a couple of minutes left of the episode, so let's finish that up. And also, it's also a couple of one or two of the other things I needed to address that people were asking about online. We kind of cut away from this, and we get a scene between Holcomb and Ennis. We see them splitting money that's being paid to them by that casino guy. And then, shortly thereafter, Ennis is murdered by a few Asian men. These are presumably men who are working on behalf of Wu Sing. Basically an obvious underworld character that we never actually met Wu Sing, correct? He was just referred to a couple times.
Correct. We wondered if we ever would, and we right. didn't.
It's one of those will, and you almost wonder, oh, is this going to be one of those, you know, evil names that we've heard, but will we see at some point in the future? You know, either if they get a few seasons, you know, by season three, we will actually meet Wu. You know, Wu Sing or not. So there were some questions about this that I had read online from some of our friends and acquaintances were speculating or wondering whether Holcomb was actually the person who had orchestrated, you know, the original plan or not, or who was doing what. Let me put a little bit of this to some rest. Some of it's going to be what I know to be true, and some of it's going to be what I think to be true. They kind of established on the series, it's even said a few times, you know, Holcomb's probably the smarter of these two guys. And Holcomb's clearly corrupt. You know, he's part of all this. Do I think he played a bigger part than what we'd already seen? No, I don't think he played a bigger part. I think it was about, because now we get into the aspects of the season that may not have been, if not fully addressed, fully resolved to maybe some people's liking. Because whenever you're dealing with a film noir story, when you deal with money and blackmail, there's going to be some confusion and muddlement. And there certainly is with this. So we can presume that, you know, although the money was originally, I think the original plan was hatched, you know, in order to help the church because of, you know, what Gannon was trying to do and at Seidel's BS, whatever. I think once you got the underworld involved, as in Wu Sing, whatever, that was who was really going to be getting the money out of this. And that, I think it's the cut of that money is what these guys were paid. And now someone's going to say, but wait, and here's one of the confusing things. What about the money that got burned? Because that was that whole big thing about, you know, them finding the embers of the burned money in the fireplace. If you believe that all the money was burned in the fireplace, then this entire plot and case added up to absolutely nothing. I do not believe that is what happened. I don't think that's what happened. And I think there's even, if you go online, you might be able to find an interview with Tim Van Patten, one of the creative forces behind the season, as well as the director of most, if not all, the episodes, or felt like it was.
Five of the eight.
Excellent. So more than half the season. I believe he even addresses the money. And I'm saying, no, but it's more likely someone just threw a handful of 20s on the fire to kind of, you know, throw off the scent. But most of that money was probably taken and recovered. So that's my belief that, you know, this whole thing was orchestrated, but the money was actually taken by, you know, by these underworld figures like, you know, Wu Xing, whatever, and the detectives were just getting their cut in those envelopes. So that's the way I foresaw it. I mean, as far as which cop was the original connection, my feeling is both these guys were already knee deep in, you know, paying, you know, either doing payoffs with brothels and whatever. So I don't know if one was, it's just the fact that Ennis was the one who was more involved. And Ennis is doing the legwork or the actual killing. But I don't know if he did, I don't feel he did these things without, Holcomb's knowledge. That's not the way I interpreted it, at least.
No, but what I think is, when Ennis botched some of this, Holcomb was very concerned about this coming back on him. And we saw that scene in the garage, which was Holcomb's first turn as the big heavy compared to Ennis. Mm-hmm. That clearly, if someone had to go, Holcomb was okay with Ennis going because Ennis was more unpredictable, more unreliable, and is the one that could bring it back on all of them. So you cut Ennis out and they're all safe. Now, I don't think that means that Holcomb planned his murder, but the involvement of the prostitute in the underworld when they wanted him gone, I'm sure Holcomb more than happily drove him there. And
Ennis was both a loose cannon and a loose thread. So much like, and Holcomb almost foreshadowed it in a previous episode about removing all the people that could, you know, could lead back to him, Ennis would be the last one. And yes, it did occur to me most definitely that with Ennis killing the girl from the brothel, that we don't know this for a fact, but that very, very likely did not go, might not have been authorized or gone over well with Wu Xing either. Hence his men being the one to do the drowning here.
So. Maybe. And you know, it's possible. It's possible when Perry talked to the other girl in the brothel and they burst in on him and threw him out. It's possible that was the confirmation they needed. So in an indirect way, Perry may have resulted in Ennis being killed.
That is very possible. And I almost wish Perry knew about that. Although I'm guessing at some point Perry will have figured out that he's probably... Well, they'll probably... You think they'll find his body, or you think they're just going to make him disappear? I wonder.
I think they'll give him to Mr. Wu, and he'll never be seen again.
He'll be fed to the pigs. Oh, that's a different... Yeah. That's a different Wu. wrong show. It's a Deadwood joke for the people who haven't watched Deadwood. Never mind. Anyway, character's name was Wu in Deadwood, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That was only slightly racist on my part. Okay, so. Hello? Microphone working? Okay. Anyway. So, yeah, I hopefully, between the two of us, kind of covered that aspect of it. I'm looking to see if there's anything else. Yeah, and like I said, although I think the original hatching of the plot was, you know, sidle in the church behind it so that they would get the money. Obviously, the way it worked out, they never got the money. And so who got the money? It's got to be, you know, the actual people that Holcomb and Ennis were working for, which I would imagine, because we see the casino guy's involvement and paying some stuff. So it's got to be it's just the whole shady underworld kind of a thing going on there.
Well, and if you want to talk about the burned money, who could come up and generate enough fake-looking counterfeit money to probably throw in a fireplace. I mean, I would imagine a 1930s casino guy could probably.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of it being counterfeit. I just assumed they just sacrificed a bit of the money burning it that way.
They may have, but if you wanted just somebody who knows money and could get their hands on counterfeit money, I'm sure a 1930s illicit casino could get its hand on counterfeit money.
All right, no, that's possible. I probably wouldn't leap to that only because that just becomes one detail too many that I would need substantiated to some level, I would think. But as opposed to where I could buy just tossing a few 20s in there or whatever it was, you know, just because it's not like no one's going to be measuring the amount of ash and seeing if that would equal $100,000 or not.
Right.
The other thing. Like I said, we don't really know about the whereabouts, whatever happened to the baby's body, but we have spoken about that already. It is rather garish to think that the only reason that the baby's eyes were sewn open was just for that one second or two that by looking out the window, they would see the baby's eyes were open and thus know the baby was, I guess, alive or something. Kind of a weird idea, because if the baby's eyes were closed, wouldn't they just think the baby was asleep? It seems to be a rather gruesome extent to go to. I mean, I don't know. I'll go along with it. It just seems like, really, that you went to that length for that moment? All right, okay. That's the way I felt about it, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, the writer in me felt that we're doing this because we want to have the metaphor of literally a loose thread. And the fact that it's the last thing we see in the episode is not a coincidence.
You know? No, it's meta as hell.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And hey, speaking of the end of the episode, that's one thing I haven't gotten to. So let's quickly just get there now. Because, you know, with Paul's help, Perry has tracked down Sister Alice, and she's a waitress in this little diner. I think diner might be in Carmel or Santa Clarita or San Pedro, one of those places. Actually, I have a reason why I mentioned those other places, which I'm going to get to in a minute. But we close the episode with these two. And I also like the fact that, you know, they're looking out over the Pacific Ocean. It's visual shorthand for a character looking out at their future. Anytime you see that, that's what that means when you see it in a movie or a TV show. I was like, okay, you're looking at your future. I like the scene between them. It made me wish that maybe there could be more of something between these two, but the confines of this storyline prevented that, I think. Maybe they're just two very likable actors and I would like to see them do something else. Or have been able to have a relationship, but as they point out in the scene, they're more meant to be alone at this point. So I liked it, and especially the way it ended with him saying, "Did you really think you could bring Charlie back?" And she says, "I did, didn't I?" That was a really nice way to end it.
Yeah, I liked this interaction. I wasn't sure where it was going to go, but I liked the way that it ended. And just by way of information, if Tim Van Patten in an interview after the finale did say that the possibility of Tatiana Maslany returning that's not been decided. There's a possibility she comes back. And
oh, that's interesting.
So, you know, if she comes back, there definitely is some chemistry between the two of them that you know, we could maybe explore. But you know, I thought it was a nice ending, and it is, you know, you talked about this earlier. It is funny that in any film noir, there's a MacGuffin, and that thread was a MacGuffin.
Yeah. And the fact that he literally blows it away. You know, as he's as I said before, he's looking at his future. He's holding a loose thread. He lets it blow away. He's also telling you or telling the audience, okay, there are much the way most film noir stories are, by the way. There's nothing new here. Anything that's just unresolved or not answered, it's not that big a deal. Let it go. You know, it's like, and blowing it away, it's almost like blowing away, it's almost like a wish. Like,
you know, like, and it was used to hold Charlie's eye open, eyelash, yeah. And you blow an eyelash to make a wish.
There you go. One of the fun things that was kind of cool about, I'm just looking at something here. Okay, because I have my little. All right. Well, I'm gonna save that. I'll talk about it right now since we're already at that scene. We started this podcast and I was talking about my affection for the film noir genre to begin with. Whether it be obviously the movies of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, or even when there's been more modern takes or period pieces done in later years. And what I usually go to first and foremost is Chinatown. Chinatown is one of my all-time favorite movies. I think it's one of the two or three greatest movie scripts of all time, yada, yada, yada. And the fact that, you know, it was in one of those articles or interviews, I think, again, with Tim Van Patten, where I discovered that some of the scenes that we see in this very episode, in fact, were pretty much shot on location where they shot a number of scenes from Chinatown. So all the stuff you see with them at the diner and then on the cliffside, those were the pretty much, you know, a stone's throw or less away from the area where the scenes in Chinatown, for folks who have seen Chinatown, and nothing I say is going to be a spoiler anyway if you haven't seen it, scenes in that movie when he's doing surveillance of the guy by those aqueducts outside where the water comes pouring out of the sewer, or when he puts down the watches under the wheels of a guy's car to determine what time he leaves, all those where that was all shot is where they shot the end of this episode. So I thought that was a kind of a nice little nod to one of the things that definitely helped to inspire, if not the story, definitely the way this show was put together and the direction of it and the feel of it. You can't really do much better than Chinatown when it comes to that anyway. So I definitely got a major kick out of that.
Well, that's why we keep you around, Scott, for stuff like that.
Well, I'm going to give you, I'll give you something even wackier. So I'm doing my research on this. I had forgotten that there were these Perry Mason films. There are actually, and you can track them down, there is actually six of them that were done in the 1930s. I think they were like from 1934 to 1937. Now, one of them was the one I mentioned, you know, based on his first case, the clause. There is something really interesting about another one, and I kind of link it to a movie like The Big Chill. And now you're going, well, where the fuck are you going with this? All right. People remember the movie. I'm sure you've seen The Big Chill, right? People remember. People remember The Big Chill mostly for, you know, for the soundtrack and the cast. It's like, oh, it's this one. And it's Kevin Kline or Joe Beth Williams. What the fuck was it? One of the other things The Big Chill is notable for, or trivia-wise at least, is before anyone knew who he was, Kevin Costner was originally in that movie. He's actually the person who's dead in the beginning, the corpse. They had shot a little bit with him, and I think that was cut out. So just the body you're seeing in the beginning of The Big Chill is actually Kevin Costner, before anyone knew who Kevin Costner was. In the Perry Mason movie, there was one called The Case of the Curious Bride. There's a similar thing happens in that one. There's a guy in that movie who is a corpse. I think there may be a minute or two of him on screen, but he doesn't have any dialogue. So it's virtually similar to the Kevin Costner situation in The Big Chill. That was Errol Flynn. Errol Flynn had his first screen appearance is as a corpse in a Perry Mason movie. So and for everyone who doesn't know what Errol Flynn is, why are you listening to my podcast? But for everyone who does, hopefully you got a kick out of that little nugget of information.
So apparently if you want to succeed, play a corpse in the first couple of minutes and don't speak, I'm Perry Mason.
Yeah, exactly. And then it was just like 5 years later, the dude's Robin Hood, you know, 4 years later. So it's pretty impressive. Just the way, you know, just with and coincidentally, just 4 or 5 years later, Kevin Costner was Robin Hood. Oh my God, I just made a connection I didn't know I was going to make.
Yep.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say the thing that probably made me the happiest in this whole stupid episode. Well, not stupid, great episode. Fine episode. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did I not mention at some point during this podcast previous week that I've been waiting and waiting for them to use the actual Perry Mason theme at some point?
Yes, you did.
Because the original Perry Mason theme, it's, you know, it's this brassy, jazzy, you know, it's pretty iconic as well. And it would certainly, if played the right way, it would certainly fit with what they're doing with this 1930s version. And give them all the credit in the world. Guess what music they used? A new version, but still it's the version. Over the end credits, they play the entire Perry Mason theme, the long version, the entire Perry Mason theme. I was over the moon when I heard. I recognized it within like 5 seconds. Like, oh my God, I can't believe it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. Really brassy version. I think I don't know if Terrence Blanchard is the one that performed it. I know he's done some of the music.
He is.
Because, but it was great.
I actually tracked it down. Someone had posted it. It was posted on YouTube a few hours later, and with his name on it, so that he does have the credit as being the composer or whatever. And if you don't think I'm going to end the podcast without using that music, you're out of your mind. You know I'm going to be using it. So,
as you should.
So, you know, that's kind of a wrap on the episode. And overall, for the season and the show, I know there were some people who initially were negative about this show. I never was. I really enjoyed it. I didn't have an issue with the pacing of it. There may be some who feel it's not the fastest moving show. I think it would be weird if it was faster paced. I'm quite fine with the pace that it moves at. I find comments like that remind me of the way people would talk about a number. Pretty much all the really great shows over the last 20 years, there was always people complaining about the pace. You know, either it be The Sopranos or Mad Men or whatever. Like, oh, I wish the show moved faster. I was like, oh, you know, I don't know. It's not 24, I'm sorry. But I really enjoyed the series to a great extent, and I'm looking forward to what they're going to do for a second season, most definitely.
Well, I will say that you and I, on a lark, decided to podcast about this. And it's been a really enjoyable 8 weeks of watching this show. Not much inspires me to have appointment television. And this was appointment television for me. I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed podcasting about it with you. And I think we should feel excited that I saw in Variety that this got huge ratings. This episode had a huge number for HBO. So I'm hoping it goes well. Matthew Rhys has become a favorite of yours and mine, and this is a great vehicle for him. I've loved it, and I want to say I'll end my thoughts with a close friend of mine who's also a criminal defense lawyer. Lost his son in an automobile accident this week, and I will dedicate this podcast and dedicate this to him in honor of that. That there are great criminal defense lawyers and great men, and I hope Perry Mason continues on that path to be a great person and a fighter for justice, like my friend. And Scott, it's been an honor and a joy to do this with you, and I can't wait for season two.
I didn't know I'd be ending the podcast where I'd be getting a little teary here, man. Gosh, that was very nice. Sweet. Okay. The feeling is mutual, and I'm cutting it short because I'm trying. I see the clock, so I want to wrap this up for us here so we can both get some sleep. So, hey kids, if you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows. like Perry Mason, like Fargo, which is coming back on September 27th. So excited. And so many other TV shows you may find to talk about there as well. You can also find us. Hey, I now know how to refer to it. I keep calling it iTunes. Look up your Apple Podcasts. Guess what? It's probably an app that's already on your computer or whatever. That's where you're supposed to go nowadays. You don't say iTunes. You say Apple Podcasts. Go to your Apple Podcasts where you can subscribe to our feed. Excuse me. And you can rate and review us there as well. You can actually just go to the place where you can find all of our podcasts. Because you can't find them all on Apple Podcasts. They still go back that far. They only show you the last 50. But you can check out all 260... Lord, what number are we up to now? 267? I'm going to say 267. 267 podcasts are to be found on stvdpodcast.podbean.com. It's spelled just the way it sounds. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at stvdpodcast. That's stvd as in serious TV drama, the podcast. All right, well, that wraps up Perry Mason. I have mentioned in a few previous podcasts that I was hoping to do a couple other ones in the next week or so. I don't know if they're going to happen or not. I have not really spoken with other people. I don't know about scheduling and work and so on and so forth. Ostensibly, I was hoping to do an Umbrella Academy podcast, possibly even a Stargirl one, even though I don't know how many people would actually be interested in that one. That one might be just doing it for myself. Or maybe me and Jason might talk about Stargirl and spend 20 minutes talking about all the other geeky stuff that we haven't talked about in the last year or two. Very possible, because I haven't really talked about that kind of stuff on the podcast as much, except for Doom Patrol. That'll be one thing we can't talk about. So, no, we already gave Doom Patrol 2.5 hours on the podcast. They don't get any more time. no more for you. But we might spend an hour talking about Harley Quinn for all I know, because now I'm 3 episodes away from finishing that series. And it started off being like, they're just cursing all the time too. Wow, this is actually a really funny, really good show. Anyway, I don't know. I have to figure it out. So there may be a couple more podcasts in the pipeline in the next week or two. Or there may not be anything till September. I'm really not sure. I don't want to say I want to do one about The Boys if I don't knock off one about the Umbrella Academy. So basically, if I do the Umbrella Academy, then I'll probably do one about season 2 of The Boys as well. If I don't do one, then I'm probably not going to do the other one. In which case, we may take a very long sabbatical. We'll see. I obviously haven't figured it out, but we will. Anyway, that's pretty much it. Brian, again, thank you so much for being more than amenable to doing this podcast. You made it a joy to do as well, not just because of your legal insight, because of just, I just enjoy hearing your voice and talking with you. So it's just always fun. And, you know, and you don't snippily berate me the way Dan does. So I'm just kidding.
Well, I enjoyed the show. I was honored you asked me if I would be interested, and I've enjoyed having this conversation with you each week.
Excellent. It's especially for the last 8 weeks, since we both have been, just like everyone, probably all our listeners, have been dealing with being stuck at home most of the time due to quarantines and pandemics or whatever. So it's a nice little respite, even if it's only for an hour. Or in the case of Doom Patrol, 2.5 hours or whatever.
Right.
And, oh, by the way, kids, if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the Doom Patrol one that me and Brian recorded last week, please track that one down. It's super long. You may want to break it up over a few days, but I think we both gave it our all. It's a really good podcast. So, and then, you know, and if you haven't watched Doom Patrol, go back and just go listen to the first 1/2 hour, then stop. You know, I'm telling you, check it out. It's worth it.
Yep. It sure is.
All right. And with all that, I will, like, for the last time, say goodnight to everybody out there. Goodnight to you, Brian, and I will let you close it out.
Thank you, everybody. Hope to see you for season 2 sometime next year.